The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is Rohit Bhargava, author of The Non-Obvious Guide to Small Business Marketing Without a Big Budget, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by Forbes as one of 11 smart podcasts that will keep you in the know. My goal for this podcast is to help you discover new ideas in order to succeed in the quickly changing field of modern marketing and sales. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you are a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or some other helpful resource that I know of for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat and I'll try to point you in the right direction. This show is produced by my marketing firm. We work with manufacturers to help them grow. If you're a manufacturer and are serious about growing your business, check out our guide to lead generation for manufacturers on our website, salesartillery.com, or Google lead generation for manufacturers and you'll find the guide at the top of the organic results. And special thanks to this episode's sponsor, Blinkist. Blinkist is a really cool app that takes the key insights from the best nonfiction books and distills them into a format that you can read or listen to in just 15 minutes on your smartphone. Several of the books featured on the Marketing Book Podcast are on Blinkist. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer for Marketing Book Podcast listeners where you can sign up for free at Blinkist.com/Marketing Book Podcast. Blinkist is spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, and if you opt for the paid version, you'll get an additional 20% off, but only if you go to Blinkist.com/Marketing Book Podcast or just click on the link at MarketingBookPodcast.com. And now, on with the show. Today, we welcome Rohit Bhargava back to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about his book, The Non-Obvious Guide to Small Business Marketing Without a Big Budget, published by Idea Press. Rohit Bhargava is the Wall Street Journal best-selling author of 5 books on topics as wide-ranging as the future of business, how to build a brand with personality, and why leaders always eat left-handed. His signature book, Non-Obvious, has been read or shared by over 1 million readers. It features 15 annual trend predictions and is in its 8th year of publication and has been the first episode of the Marketing Book Podcast for the past 3 years. Rohit is the founder of 3 successful companies and advises multiple startups and teaches marketing and storytelling at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., Go Hoyas. He previously spent over 15 years leading digital and innovation strategy for global brands at Leo Burnett and Ogilvy. His thinking has been featured on National Public Radio, Fast Company, and the Harvard Business Review, and he writes a monthly column for GQ magazine in Brazil. As a non-boring keynote speaker, Rohit has been invited to deliver multiple TEDx talks and taken the stage at over 500 events in 31 countries around the world. And interesting fact, Rohit is now the only member of the Marketing Book Podcast 4-Timers Club. Rohit, congratulations on the non-obvious guide to small business marketing without a big budget, and welcome back to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you. I feel like I'm blazing a new trail here.
You are. Now, in full disclosure, Mark Schaefer was once in the Marketing Book Podcast 4-Timers Club, but he has since moved on to number 5. So
okay, so now I have something to aspire to.
That's right. And, you know, if he doesn't hurry up and write another book, and I play my cards right, I might get you back on the podcast the first week of January 2020, and then there's a Five Timers Club issue going on. So
the competition's on. I'm going to tell Mark.
Okay, I'm sure you must run into him from time to time. I know he goes to a lot of the same shows you do, and probably shares some of the same stages.
I'm sure we do. Yeah.
So I do have one thing to say about your book. First off, Rohit, when I saw the title of the book, I just thought, you know, small business marketing without a big budget. And I just wanted to give you some advice. I said, Rohit, I mean, that can't be a big, you know, that can't be a big issue. That can't be a large addressable market. I'm kidding, of course. But the dirty little secret about this book, Mr. Bhargava, is this book is not just for small businesses. There are Fortune 500 companies that should be doing a number of the things that you talk about in this book.
Yeah, and in fact, it's funny because it seemed initially to people who know me and know the work that I do to be a really odd category for me to write for, because pretty much 100% of the work that I do is for big companies, and most of my background in that, you know, awesome introduction that you read is all about working with big companies. So I understand the whole deal with lots of different layers of approvals and all of the BS that goes with working with a big company and the details of that. And this book, when I started putting it out there, of course, the first group that I went out to was the people who I already work with. And you're right, the big companies looked at this. They said, you know, it says small business on there, but like, we need some of this stuff too.
Oh, sorely, sorely. Now, I'm going to quote from your book. This is a very, very readable book, and it was, I've never read a 200-page book so quickly. Very, very scannable. But what was also interesting is, you know, small business marketing, it could be a 1,000-page book, but what was so interesting to me is what you focused on. So in other words, just the really, really important concepts. I just want to quote from one part in the preface that establishes your bona fides as a small business person also. So they won't think, oh, it's just big time Rohit, you know, Leo Burnett, Ogilvy, that kind of thing. You wrote, "How I became an entrepreneur. After leaving my agency job nearly 5 years ago, I started my first business with my wife, and a year later, we started a second one. For each, we had to build a brand, develop a marketing strategy, devise ways to attract and retain customers, and sell a service for one and a physical product for the other. Along the way, I discovered that many things I thought I knew about marketing were wrong. Instead of working with million-dollar advertising budgets, I was now an entrepreneur with non-existent marketing budget. So my thinking changed. I started working faster and avoiding waste. I focused on what succeeded and ignored everything else. Within a few years, my first business passed $1 million in revenue. A year later, the second did the same. What was my secret? How did a traditional marketer like me reinvent the big company approach to prosper without relying on big spending? I wrote this book to answer those questions." So, Rohit, you write that marketing is how you share the story of your business with the world to inspire belief and encourage action. However, we are in what you describe as an era of believability crisis. What is this modern crisis of believability that we're in?
I think it's a natural result of the fact that we just don't know what to believe anymore. There's a lot of people who are trying to manipulate us and doing a pretty damn good job of it. And so when we're surrounded by that and we don't know who's got our interest at heart, or if anybody does, we become skeptical of everything. And that's not a situation that only affects a certain industry or a certain sector. I mean, that's the world that affects all of us.
Well, is this solely the fault of marketers and marketing people?
No, I mean, I think, well, marketing's one group to blame, I think. But you could also look at politics and politicians. You could look at media and the idea that everything has to be breaking news, even when it isn't. And those things are all combining.
Yes. So we're in a crisis of believability. What can people and companies do then, in light of that, to become more believable these days?
Well, the nice thing is when you're thinking about small businesses, there's a natural advantage, which is you are usually run by an actual person and there's a real human with a face behind the business. Now, the problem is that a lot of small businesses work really hard to be like their bigger competitors, and they leave behind the one advantage they should have, which is, hey, there's a real person here. There's somebody to call. There's somebody to talk to. And so I think that what happens is, in a world where we don't know what to trust, a lot of people are starting to retreat inwards. And what that means is they trust the people that they know, they trust the relationships they have, and they double down on what they already believe. And the upside of that is that we value these personal relationships much more because that's who we trust. The downside is people are going back to kind of believing what they believe and seeing the rest of the world and thinking anybody who doesn't think the way they do must be stupid. And that's not so good.
No, no. And actually, not to keep talking about Mark Schaefer, who, you know, the word's out now that Rohit's coming after him. So, but Mark Schaefer's most recent book was on the podcast, and it was The Marketing Rebellion. And it talks about when all is said and done, the most human company wins. And he has example after example of why that's working now. And just to lump you in with Mark Schaefer and Philip Kotler, the father of modern marketing, in his book, Marketing 3.0, where I interviewed him for the 100th episode of this show, he talked about in this digital age, being human is so much more important, even to the point where if you can show vulnerability, that's actually an asset towards becoming more believable and liked and preferred by prospective customers.
Yeah, you know, I've written a lot about this idea that is essentially that, and I called it lovable imperfection. And yes, to me, lovable imperfection is why people wear Crocs. You know, it's why we choose these authentic products because they have this reality to them that feels approachable.
So as we record this, Rohit, it's about lunchtime here on the East Coast. We're both in Virginia. And I'm kind of hungry, and I could go for some chicken. And I just wanted to ask you to explain this one concept based on a restaurant you were talking about from Chicago. What is a chicken strategy, and why do businesses not need one?
Yeah, this is my hopefully humorous analogy to explain the way that a lot of people think about marketing, which is they don't focus on the big picture. They focus on the tactic. And so when I hear people say, we need a Facebook strategy or we need an email strategy, to me, that's as if a restaurant said, we need a chicken strategy. And of course, restaurants don't have a chicken strategy for like how to promote chicken. They have a strategy for creating a great experience. And chicken might be on the menu. It might be like one thing, but it's not the whole thing. And even a chicken restaurant, right, that just sells chicken, like they still have other things in their experience. Mm-hmm. As the reason why people go there. And so I think we have to get out of this mentality of saying, like, what's my strategy for this one little thing? Because that one little thing is hot right now.
Right, right. A shiny disco ball. Or I've also heard it described as management by InFlight magazine. So the CEO, let's say he or she is the CEO of a industrial sewage pump business, very good products, comes in and throws the InFlight magazine on the table full of new ideas and says, okay, what's our Snapchat strategy?
Yeah. And, you know, I sort of allude to this idea that having a strategy is super important, but we're not generally taught how to do that, right? We're not necessarily naturally great strategic thinkers, especially when you start running a small business, you focus on the execution, right? I mean, you're just doing what you're doing. And if it's going well, you start doing more of it. I mean, you're reacting to what's working, which is, there's nothing wrong with that. The challenge is when you start thinking about strategy, sometimes you can strategically choose to do nothing, right?
Yes.
But that's a strategy. Like if you choose to do that, that's great, you know? And I tell this story at one point in the book about me doing this really dumb thing that you'll appreciate given the number of, you know, authors and your world that you live in, which is I created a Twitter account for a book, one of the books that I wrote.
Oh, right. You mentioned that. Yeah.
Yeah. So now I had my Twitter account for me. And then I also had a Twitter account for the book, and I had this bright idea that I was going to tweet as if I was the book. So I would have the voice of the book, which was fun for a little while until eventually I realized that now I've got to keep two Twitter accounts up to date, which sucks. So eventually, 6 months later, I realized I wasn't going to be able to keep this up. And I had a choice to make, which is, okay, now I've started this Twitter account. I could just let it die and not post on it anymore. But I spent some time building it up and I wanted to leverage it. And so I decided that what I was going to do was essentially sunset it. I was going to do one post, one final post saying, hey, this was great. I had a fun time. I'm not going to post here anymore. If you want to get the latest insights, follow Rohit over here because he clearly has more time than I do, right?
Yeah.
And it was kind of a joke, but the whole idea was like, tell people where else to go and then just create it as like a redirect, right? Which is a strategy. So I strategically chose to shut it down and not do anything on it anymore. And I think we don't give ourselves permission to do that often enough.
That is so true. And that is such a great concept. And at the Content Marketing World a year or so ago, I was doing a workshop on industrial manufacturing with Rebecca Geyer, author of Smart Marketing for Engineers. And what we did was she was leading a panel discussion, and then I was going through the audience. Older people will bring to mind Phil Donahue. And I had a microphone, but rather than asking people to state their questions, I had them write it down on some cards. Doing so helps to cut down on speeches being given and forces people to ask a question. So one of the questions, and I still have the card right here on my desk, was, how and when do you decide to stop doing something? That was a brilliant question, because there's a lot of things where you should say, well, before you go do something, decide, well, how will we decide if we don't want to do this anymore? But and unfortunately, a lot of what marketers are doing is very additive. So let's talk about what you argue is the world's most common marketing mistake. Why, Rohit Bhargava, is setting a budget the world's most common marketing mistake?
It's pretty simple. When you set a budget, you have to spend it. And when you think in that term, when you think in those terms, you end up going down a certain route that may not be the smartest route to go. And so, for example, let's say that you've got a great product that you're trying to engage influencers in to talk about. And if you say, I'm going to spend $1,000 on advertising this, now all of a sudden you start looking for ads and ways to promote it that might reach those influencers, but might not. Instead of saying, look, these are the 10 people who have the audience that I desperately want to reach. And what I want to do is I want these 10 people to love my product. And so maybe you spend some money on that. Maybe you don't. Maybe you give them products. Maybe you give them an experience. Maybe you give them something entirely different. Maybe it costs you overall way more than $1,000, but you don't spend any of that $1,000 in traditional ad units. The question is not, how do I spend $1,000? Because that's my budget. The question should be, how do I get these people, the right people, to love what I have so that they'll talk about it because they love it?
Yes. And you're asking that all-important question that sometimes is skipped over in the marketing world, what is it exactly we're trying to accomplish?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that ultimately what we want, a lot of times people put it in terms of attention, right? We just need to get attention, because if we had attention, then all the other things would happen. But you know what else gets attention? Like taking off all your clothes and running through the middle of Penn Station, that would get attention.
Don't I know that?
But yeah, exactly. But you probably wouldn't sell much, right?
Well, I got arrested, but go ahead.
Yeah, you'd probably get arrested too, right? I mean, it'd be funny, but if you didn't have a reason for doing that that actually generated a result, then you would get attention, but nothing else.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of times what ends up happening is we get attention and nothing else because we didn't focus on actually changing belief or inspiring some sort of action that matters. And I say that very intentionally, like action that matters, right? How important is it that somebody clicks a like button? Like, what does that mean? You know what I mean? And like that is the challenge sometimes too, that we all of this, all of these media properties that we've got are driving us towards the quote unquote conversion of somebody clicking a button when that may not generate all that much for you.
Yeah, it brought to mind what you had on page 192 for those keeping for those keeping track at home. It's not just like as it relates to measurement, which we'll get to. You talk about the four A's, which were awareness. Okay, we've talked. That's kind of where most of them stop. But awareness, advocacy, action, and alignment. Think through what it is you want them specifically to do And I think it might even become what would appear to be a more manageable goal for, you know, whatever that budget is. But so let's go on from the budget, though. More important than setting a budget, you talk about the value of being different. And you quoted Sally Hogshead, where she said, being the best isn't enough if nobody cares. Different is better than better. Explain what's going on there.
Yeah, I think a lot of times we get this advice that we have to have the best product. We have to have the best features. And probably in every industry, you could find an example of something that was quantifiably on paper better, but it doesn't take off the same way that something else takes off. Mm-hmm. Because what they have focused on is the wrong thing. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't try and make the best product or the best service you possibly can, but expecting that you have the best thing and therefore you will win is a huge mistake, because that doesn't happen. That doesn't reflect reality.
Well, you talk about how the best marketing strategies start with this discussion of, you know, an answer to the question, what is the one thing you offer that is different and that your audience cares about? Where do companies go wrong with this? Is it relates to focusing on what their audience actually cares about?
Not necessarily. I mean, I think we should give people credit. I mean, I think people in general, when they have a company, they sort of do have an idea of what people want. It's not like they're totally clueless.
Right.
I think what tends to happen is, A, we overvalue how much people desperately want the thing that we have. So we think they want it a lot more than maybe they do, or we think that they really can't live without it when they'd be just fine without it. And I think the other thing is we overvalue how different we are. We think, oh man, nobody else could possibly do this one thing in this one little way. And yet when we communicate it to someone, they don't see the difference that much. They're like, okay, your dirt is like got slightly more microbiomes in it, and I'm supposed to care why. They don't see that huge, that thing that was a huge difference for us when we were in the boardroom, like brainstorming, is not actually that big of a difference when you go into the real world.
Yes. Well, this goes to understanding your customer, which in my book, that's the key to success in business, is just having a better understanding of your customer. Explain why demographics are an outdated way to describe your audience.
Because not every 25-year-old likes the same thing. I mean, you know, I mean, it's perfectly obvious if you describe it in that way, right? But the demographics say, okay, if you're 25, or if you're age 25 to 34, this is what you like. Now, think about like the most idiotic demographic, which is 18 to 44. You're telling me that like an 18-year-old could like think exactly the same way as a 44-year-old, and you're going to market to them exactly the same way? I mean, this is completely idiotic, right? You would have much better success if instead you tried to focus on, for example, forget about the age of someone.
Yeah.
Just market to them based on if they happen to have a 5-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. Regardless of if they're 25 years old or they're 44-year-old, because a 25-year-old or a 44-year-old who both have a 5-year-old kid are going to have a lot more in common in terms of what they buy, what they care about, the lives that they lead, than two people who are both exactly 25 years old, but one of them has a 5-year-old kid and one of them has no kids.
Yes. Right?
So like, the sorts of things you should be paying attention to are how people are living their lives, not what age they happen to be or what gender they happen to be. Those are stupid ways that we buy advertising and waste our money.
Absolutely. And I believe it was Professor Malcolm McDonald from the UK in his book on marketing planning. He talked about how the Archbishop of Canterbury and Boy George were both in the same demographic.
Yeah. You know, and it makes it, you know, I mean, I think like it's easy for us to look at it and criticize it. The reason why it exists is to make selling advertising easier for the people selling advertising. And there's a reason for it, right? And it's not that they're evil. They need a way to sell what they have. But it doesn't mean that you need to think about your audience in that way or value it as being meaningful.
Yes. It seems like it's tying one hand behind the back of a modern marketer in trying to be successful. So instead of this obsession with demographics, and I mean, you came from big agencies, I came from big agencies. That's why I wanted to bring this up. It was so pervasive. And it's not something that you know, we really talk about anymore, or it's not the first thing we focus on. But we do focus on what you call customer personas. So explain the idea of a customer persona and some of the things that you should be doing to develop one correctly.
Yeah, the difference between a customer persona and a demographic is a demographic just looks at your details. This is a 27-year-old male who lives in this city, who is married with 1.5 children, right? Which in reality, like, nobody has 0.5 of a children. People have like one kid or two kids,
right?
Or three or four or whatever. And so a customer persona instead describes this category that you're trying to reach in terms of the story of an individual. So a customer persona might be, our customer's name is Ravi. He's a second generation Indian from his family. He is engaged but not married. He lives in a large city. He works in this sort of environment. He goes to work every single day, but on Fridays he gets to work from home. You know, like, you basically describe it as if you're describing someone's life. Now, a persona doesn't have to be an actual person. You can make it up. You can make up the name. You can make up the life. But it should be based on what you think or what you've found through your research your customer is actually doing on a daily basis. Because then when you start to think of your marketing strategy, you can put that into terms of, okay, would Ravi pay attention to this, right? The guy who we're trying to reach, whose persona we just wrote, who's, you know, working from home on Fridays and engaged, would he pay attention to this? And mm-hmm. It gives you this really nice check to see if your marketing is actually reaching who you want it to reach.
And in your book on page 28, you even included Arya, the persona for who is buying these non-obvious guides. And it was very interesting, very detailed. And as I read it, I thought, holy cow, that's the same person who listens to this podcast. Really, really similar.
Yeah, and it's a little bit of a, you know, some of marketing is psychology, as you know. And part of the reason why we did that, A, was to just demonstrate that we're taking our own advice, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I'm using the advice that I give to people in how we're putting together this guide. And you know, one thing we didn't quite talk about is this non-obvious guide is actually the first of a huge series that we're launching with multiple authors. So there's 7 others that are in production right now. And this whole guide series, the non-obvious guide series, is something that we're really taking out there in the market to take on these long dictionary style guidebooks that you find with the dummy series, things that are only useful if you're kind of looking up the definition of something, but not really useful if you're trying to do something. So the intent of this series is to aim to that person. And this description of person who, in this case, I named Arya, is really interesting as a psychological exercise too, because the intent was, as someone's reading this, that they think to themselves, oh my God, that's me. So it reinforces the idea that, okay, this book was written for you. Right.
Right. And it's going to help you, as you already know, through all the development of all those other books, you're going to say, well, now, wait a minute. We already know that Arya doesn't like that, or Arya wants it this way.
You know, yeah. And you know, what was interesting about doing this exercise, actually going through this process of finding that persona and writing the persona, was there was one line in there where we talked about, this is the line. So thank you for telling me the page number, because it made it easy for me to find it.
I'm here to serve.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's great. So it says here, given a choice, she will always choose to have a coffee meeting to pick the brain of a mentor above any other form of learning. And that led us to this tagline, which is on the cover of all of the books, that says, like having coffee with an expert.
Yes.
Which is kind of the tone of what we're trying to take with each one of these books. It's as if you could sit down and have a coffee meeting with somebody who is really an expert and just pick their brain. And that's what these books are intended to be.
Right. But be honest here. Did you also produce this and mention the coffee? Because you probably get about 25 people a day that say, Rohit, can we get together for coffee so I can pick your brain? And then you can say, well, can I send you this book first and then maybe talk about that?
You know, you get the same requests I do. So I would love, as you, I am sure, would, to say yes to everybody. But it's tough, right? I mean, you don't always get the chance. And even more so for me, because I've never been a marketing consultant that someone who had a small business could hire. Not because you know, I'm too expensive or too egotistical or whatever. That's just not a part of my business because of how we've structured the company and the consulting and all of the things that I've done. So in a lot of cases, there was advice that I desperately wanted to share with friends and colleagues and people who I know are running small businesses, but who are not marketing people. And I didn't really have a great way of sharing that apart from doing these coffee meetings, which obviously hits a limit at a certain point.
Yes.
So the book was my chance to take all of this stuff out of my head, everything that I'd thought I'd learned from the past 15 years of leading marketing and doing all of these things, and then having my own businesses and trying to do it for my own businesses as well, and put it all into a book.
Well, there's only so much Rohit to go around.
You know, there's enough for four times of us doing this. So that's what's important.
That's right. That's why I'm lucky to have you on the show once a year. And here you are about 6 months before and after your annual kickoff episode. So there's so many other things I just wanted to go through quickly. Let's talk about positioning, which is one of the most important concepts in marketing. You write that marketing without positioning is like winking at someone in the dark. You know what you're doing, but no one else does. Explain.
Yeah, positioning is this really, really important component of strategy. And what it says is not just this is what we do and this is why we're different, but how do we compare to what else is out there? So positioning is, you know, imagine you're in the middle of a sport and you're playing, right? Your position in terms of where you play has some bearing on whether you win that play or not. If you're in the right place at the right time, if you're, you know, getting to the right place, you can actually have more success. And positioning a company is a similar idea to say, what is the position that we want to take? What do we want to be for? What do we want to be against? You know, again, to take our own advice and put it towards the guide series, one of the best things that helped me when I was crafting the vision for the entire guide series to give to all of the other authors who are working on them was, where do we fit in this market of business guidebooks? Mm-hmm. And we had a clear target, and the target was the dummies guides, because there's dummies guides and there's idiots guides, and we all know what they look like. And we all know that they're generally 350 pages, and they have definitions for like digital marketing. The dummies guide to digital marketing has 3 pages on what the web, what the internet is. All right. They're just going to define it for you. Mm-hmm. Literally nobody needs that. And so, you know, our tagline for the back of these guides and the intent was that we wanted to create smart advice for smart people. So we're really hitting against this idea that, like, look, you're not a dummy. You're not an idiot. Just because you're not a marketing expert because that's not your field doesn't make you a dummy.
Right.
And so why should we write to people as if they're dummies? Why don't we write to them as if they're smart professionals who just need to know what they need to know? And tell it to them more quickly in a shorter, more visual format that's easier to consume. And that would be the mission.
That's right. And there's even a publisher's note at the beginning of the book that says, is this guide for you? If you picked up this book, you are not a dummy. Many business guides treat you like an idiot. Some even say so on the cover. This is not one of those books. And then it goes on to talk about how this book is different. Great position.
You'll appreciate this as a fellow marketing guy. I mean, when you're small and people haven't heard of you, there's only an upside in attacking the dominant players in the industry, right? Mm-hmm. Because everybody's heard of them. And so the more I can be a little bit confrontational, right? Maybe intentionally more so, the more I can make this relevant because people have a frame of reference. They may not know what a non-obvious guide is, but they know what a dummy's guide is, and they know why it's not as useful as it could be.
Let's talk about social media. Back to the shiny disco balls we mentioned earlier. What are some of the biggest myths about social media marketing?
I think the biggest myth about social media marketing is that you have to be everywhere. You have to be on every platform. And one of the first things that I did is I created a matrix. And it was actually really fun to do because creating frameworks of your own is fun. And then creating them and then testing them to see if they actually work, and hopefully they do, is really fun too. And I ended up with this matrix of social media strategy where I said there's only 4 strategies that you can use for social media. And you can run them based on the platform. And one of the least appreciated strategies of the 4 was something that I called create a placeholder. And create a placeholder says, register your business name on Twitter and then do one tweet that says, hey, we don't post on Twitter that often. Come and check us out over here on Instagram. And that's it. Now you're done. That's your entire Twitter strategy.
That's kind of like when you retired that other Twitter account.
Yeah. But in that case, I used it for a while and then I retired it. In this case, you're literally just creating a placeholder so that you register your business's name so nobody else gets it. Mm-hmm. And then you redirect people to where you actually want them to go. So like one of the four strategies was create a placeholder. The second strategy that I talked about was join the community. So you create a username, not so much so you can start posting, but just so you can see what other people are talking about. Mm-hmm. Now, some platforms like Pinterest, for example, like they require you to create an account before you can even see everything that's going on. So when you create an account, you join the community. Maybe you post a comment every once in a while if you are so inclined. But you're using it for research, which is the other underappreciated, it's another underappreciated value of social media. You get this unfiltered stream of what people actually think. And so a lot of times when I talk to small business owners, they looked at social media as a publishing platform. Every social media platform, I have to start publishing. I have to be a creator. And that's not actually true. Like there are many of these accounts where you can just create an account solely for listening and then just start paying attention to what people are saying. Don't post anything ever. Don't be a creator. Just listen.
Be intentional about it. That seems very refreshing. And also you remind readers that having a lot of followers on social media doesn't matter if none of them really care about what you have to say. Meaning for me, stop talking about yourself so much.
Yeah. And I would say, look, I'm a contrarian, I think by nature, and also because I write a book called Non-Obvious, right? So I have to be. So there are some situations where having a lot of followers, even if they're bots, is good. One of those situations is if you are an influencer who is selling sponsorship to dumb companies, because, right. You know, and there are a lot of them. A lot of dumb companies will look at your Instagram account, and if you have 5,000 followers, or if you have 50,000, but 45,000 of them are bots, you will get them to pay you more because you have 50,000 versus 5,000. So there is a business case for having, unfortunately, I wish this wasn't the case.
Not one that we recommend.
Right? No, I mean, look, the thing is like, if you're selling to, but the thing is like, you could sell to a dumb company once based on that type of follower account. But when they come back to you and say, okay, we did this campaign, what were the results? You can imagine that the result will be pretty, pretty bad.
And they're going to tell everyone else.
Yeah. And you didn't have any real followers. So you didn't have any real engagement. You didn't end up delivering what they wanted and they're not going to come back. So you can sell something once based on this fake influence that you've got, but it doesn't work for long.
Yeah, Joel Bakaler's book, Digital Influence, which was on the podcast a while back, he talked about a influencer marketing company that was so fed up with fake influencers and more upset at companies that were buying from them stupidly, as you just mentioned. They set up a fake influencer. I think it's the thing cost them $1,500. They did a photo shoot. They did all this. They bought all the followers. And they started getting business for this from companies that didn't know what they were doing, trying to buy influence. And then, if I'm not mistaken, they ended up explaining to them that they weren't going to take their money. It was all a project to make that larger point. So one thing that's really important for small businesses and large businesses, okay, every business, is the website. And there were so many things in the book that I feel like I have questions about this every week, or I'm dealing with someone that is touching on some of these issues. And you write that if you're not in an online business, it's easy to think your site isn't very important. Why do you argue that is such a big mistake?
Well, because a website, if you're selling online, if you're doing e-commerce, obviously your website is super important because you're selling and that's how you make money and you can track that. The challenge for other businesses, I mean, if you're a local dealer of snowblowers, it's easy to think, oh, who would care about our website? Mm-hmm. But the very first thing that people do when they hear about your business is they will often go online to see whether you're reputable, to see whether what your location looks like. They might go online purely to get directions. They might go online just to look for your phone number. And it's amazing how often businesses undervalue just providing that simple service. I mean, even if you just had a one-page website that you could literally put up with a lot of these editors in 30 minutes, mm-hmm. that had one picture of your location, an easy link to the Google Map address, and the phone number super large to say, call us right now, and your opening hours, right? Just those things. You would already be far ahead of some of these people who either don't have a site, or even worse, they've invested all sorts of money to create a great site that forgets to do that basic thing and give people that basic information.
Yeah.
Which is what they really want anyway.
It's amazing. So a topic that is very familiar to listeners to the Marketing Book podcast, but maybe not always to their management, is content marketing. And remind listeners why content marketing is so popular.
Content marketing is popular because when done well, it answers the questions that people have and it provides value. So rather than advertising, which often tries to capture people and interrupt them in order to generate attention, content marketing is based on people want information, they want to learn, they want to get smarter, they're looking for research on, they're researching certain things. And if you provide the right content, you can answer their questions in a way that will then bring them into your experience or consider buying your product.
So how can companies find topics that people actually care about?
So I think that this topic question actually is pretty easy. The way you figure out what to create content about is based on what people typically ask you. Right. So, you know, you just flip it around. And, you know, that's not that complicated. The complicated part is when people start thinking, especially small businesses, about creating content, it's really hard because now they're trying to do something that they're not naturally good at and that they don't have people who are naturally good at.
Or so they for think example, they're not going to be good at.
Yeah, well, you know, sometimes they think they're not going to be good. Sometimes they're actually not good.
Oh, right? Yes, of course.
And I think that the thing with content is a lot of times we think, okay, we need to start writing blog posts. And as a writer, I will tell you, it's not easy for a lot of people to write. I mean, it's not a skill that they enjoy or that they have. But those same people might be great if somebody could take a video, take a phone and just record them answering that question in a conversation.
Yes, right? Yes.
So part of the challenge, I think, when it comes to content creation or content marketing is figure out what style of content creation is best for you. Is it better for you to just record audio of you talking on the phone to somebody and giving them advice and maybe releasing that as a podcast? Is it better for you to do a couple of photographs and show visually an answer to this question? Is it better for you to write a 500-word blog post because you have somebody to write it? Is it better to do a video, right? I mean, there's so many ways that you could create content that a lot of times it's just so frustrating because I see people like wearing, you know, the wrong hat and trying to create this content that's such a struggle for them. And what ends up happening is A, it's not very good. So nobody pays attention. And B, they don't do it because they hate it.
Yes. But wait, listener, there's more. For those of you struggling with the notion of content creation, Rohit, explain why, in certain instances, content curation might be better than content creation.
Yeah, so content curation, and I use this word a lot, if you've seen any of my talks, is based on the idea that we need people to tell us what to pay attention to. And if you think about what a curator in a museum does, no museum takes every piece of art they have and slaps it on the wall, right? They decide, based on the theme of a particular gallery showing, these are the 25 paintings we're going to show, and this is the story we're going to tell. And they curate the 25 that they show. And a lot of times what happens when you talk to small business owners is they've built an expertise in a certain category. That's why they have a business in that category. So they really know what to pay attention to. And even if they're not gifted writers or video producers or photographers, if you sent them out on the internet and basically asked them, I want to get smart about this one thing. What five articles should I read? What are the five best articles you've ever seen about this? If you just went out and found those five, took the links for those five, published those on your website and said, here are the five best things you should read, even if you didn't write them, that already is providing some value, because otherwise somebody would have to go and randomly Google. They may not find those articles. It's very difficult to see. But you taking on that role of a curator as an expert means that you're creating these lists of content that already exists.
Yes, and three great marketing newsletters that come to mind are from Chris Brogan, Christopher S. Penn, and Scott Monty. And they create a lot of their own content, but they also have these newsletters, which they spend a fair amount of time on. But it's sort of like if you only read one, read this one. Now, I should mention, you have a newsletter, and there's actually a link that we're going to include in your episode's show notes related to a whole bunch of resources associated. This thing is really very densely populated. You've got templates, everything in there, guides, videos. So we're going to include that on there. Rohit, I want to ask just two other big questions, and one of them has to do with trade shows. And you write that 80% of trade show marketers are probably wasting their money, and that estimate might even be low. So why do you say that, and what should they be doing instead, or what should they be doing?
Yeah, the trade show thing is fascinating, and I've done a few of them now.
You go to a lot of shows.
I go to a lot of shows, but not usually the trade show. You know, I mean, I'm usually speaking.
Oh, right.
But
like Consumer Electronics Show. I mean, I stalk you. I mean, follow you on social, and I see where you're. You know, you go to some of these shows. It's really kind of fun.
Yeah, it is, and we have a lot of fun with it. And I started going out and testing various things that might work. And one of the things that I realized is what makes a trade show worthwhile and work, and what makes it a waste of time. And the thing that makes it a waste of time is just buying a booth space and assuming that people are going to come in and be super interested in what you have to talk about and sitting back and waiting for them to come.
Mm-hmm.
Not a huge surprise that that would be a relative waste of time. But I think that there are some things that a lot of times people who are doing these trade shows, it's amazing that they don't think about it. And one of them is getting out of the trade show floor. Every one of the events, not everyone, but a lot of these large events, they issue open calls for speakers. And you could essentially put in a proposal to talk about something and be on stage as part of a panel or as part of a solo talk. I don't understand why every single company that is buying a booth at a trade show wouldn't at least put in a submission to try and speak. I mean, why wouldn't you want to be on the stage, which you wouldn't have to pay for, right? And sometimes, amazingly, they might even pay you to show up and talk about the thing that you have expertise in. And by the way, kind of mention during your talk that they could also learn a bit more if they came to your booth, right? It's an amazing way to drive people to the booth. And every one of these shows that we've done a booth at, whether it's to promote one of my books or whether it's to promote like the consulting group, I've always been on stage. And I can tell people, hey, come and talk to me. Come talk to my team. Come get a signed book, right? Because I have these books to give away as an asset, right? You might have something else to give away, whatever it is. And come and talk to us. And it drives a ton of traffic. And everyone else in the trade show who's looking at our booth and looking around thinking, man, how come they have all this traffic? And it's not because we are selling something magical that nobody else has. It's because we're getting off of the trade show floor, getting into the actual event, and bringing people in.
Yes, and there was also some planning that went into that that happened before the trade show started. And it seems to me like too many companies think that all they have to do is show up to the trade show and not put a whole lot of planning and thought into it. So the last question about the book I wanted to ask was, you write that a lot of marketing metrics are bullshit. Why do you say that, and what should marketers be measuring?
Well, I say it because it's true.
Agreed.
And the reason it's true, I think, is because we have a lot of what you might call feel-good metrics.
Uh-huh.
And feel-good metrics are, oh, you have this many followers, but we don't know how engaged they are. You have this many people on your list, but your open rate on your email list, but your open rate is like 4%. And so they make us feel good because it's like, oh, man, can you believe that we have 5,000 people on our list, but only 40 of them open any email you ever send? And so how valuable is that really? So the challenge, I think, with metrics is to, instead of looking at these feel-good metrics, focus instead on what I call hero metrics.
Yes.
And hero metrics are the single numbers or the single things that you can measure that tell you how well something's working across the board. So for example, if you were looking at your website metrics, one of the things you would look at is your top referrers. So what other websites are driving the most traffic or what other articles are driving the most traffic to your site. Because once you know that, you can then start to think about, okay, if we're getting 85% of our traffic from Google already, where's that traffic coming from? Are people already finding us through search? Mm-hmm. If they're already finding us through search, why would we buy keywords against the same things we're already showing up for? Now we're just wasting our money.
Oh, now you're just getting logical, Rohit.
Yeah, I know, right? So like this, these sorts of questions give you a sense of what's working and what should we be doing more of. So, which is ultimately what you want measurement to do. It's not useful for you to get a 25-page report. It sounds cool because it's like, oh my God, we're going to get all these metrics. But really, you just need a couple that tell you something that you could actually act upon.
Right. And another one you mentioned is newsletter signups. A lot goes into that, but that's a great metric of how engaged your audience is and how effective your content is. So Rohit, if readers took only one thing away from this book, what would you hope it would be?
I think it would be that strategy doesn't have to be a scary thing when it comes to marketing. Strategy is something that is within our power to think through and to do, even if we don't consider ourselves to be a quote-unquote marketer or a strategist. Because when we figure out what we're actually going to do and where we're going to spend our time, and when we use the right models for that, and I try and give people lots of models and a one-page template and all that sort of stuff to help them focus their time and effort, then what we do is going to be more successful.
Yes, strategy should not be scary. It is your friend. So are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or are looking forward to reading?
I always have a ton of books like you. I read a ton, and my output from that is much less productive, I think, than yours in terms of how frequently you do this. But every year at the end of the year, I release what I call the Non-Obvious Book Awards. And they are my picks for the most engaging, most useful, most interesting business and nonfiction books of the year. And so I published that a couple months ago for the past year. And then I do it closer to the end of the year every year. And that's kind of a compilation of everything I've been reading and the top 50. And then I narrow it down to like the top 15 for the shortlist. And then I pick five that I just absolutely loved.
You're the only author that can answer that question that way. That is a great list. It is definitely worth checking out. And we will include a link to it at your episode show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And how best can listeners learn more about you and this book?
It should be super easy. So if you just go to nonobvious.com, you can see all the guides, actually, if you go to nonobvious.com/guides. Or if you want to learn about me and even watch some of the videos that I referenced and a lot of that other content, you can go to rohitbhargava.com, just my personal site as well.
Right. And like I said earlier, we're going to have a link to the specific page, the resource page for this book. It's definitely worth taking a look at. There's so much value put on there in terms of templates, checklists, all that sort of thing. So we will do that. And at your show notes, we'll include your LinkedIn profile, your Twitter handle that you use, not the old one, at marketingbookpodcast.com so that listeners can reach out to you. And I would urge listeners to thank Rohit for being on the podcast again, and please congratulate him on becoming the current only member of the Marketing Book Podcast Four Timers Club, which, you know, he would appreciate hearing from you. But of course, he's also going to be getting those early bird discounts at the Oakton, Virginia Olive Garden, which it's a big deal becoming a member of that exclusive club. So anyway, for you, dear listener, if you're listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on Apple Podcasts or whatever your favorite podcast app is, all these links can be found by going to this episode's on your podcast player and clicking on the show notes link. The name of the book is The Non-Obvious Guide to Small Business Marketing Without a Big Budget. The author is Rohit Bhargava. Rohit, thank you very much for returning to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you. It's always a great conversation.
And that closes the book on episode 225 of the Marketing Book Podcast. For more, check out this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or other helpful resource for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat and I'll try to point you in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. Special thanks to our sponsor, Blinkist. To support the Marketing Book Podcast and start your free Blinkist trial or get 20% off your yearly plan, visit Blinkist.com/Marketing Book Podcast or just click on the link at MarketingBookPodcast.com. And please join us next time as we welcome Todd Capone to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about his book, The Transparency Sale, How Unexpected Honesty and Understanding the Buying Brain Can Transform Your Results. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast. This episode was produced by Sean Armstrong.